Today's program has been brought to you by 360 Cookware. Their stainless steel cookware uses vapor technology to cook better tasting, more nutritional food. To learn more and receive 20% off, click their logo on our website, heritageradionetwork.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello and welcome to Chef's Story. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from the International Culinary Center in New York, but we're out at gorgeous Roberta's, even though it's December and cold. It's nice and warm in here. You can smell the pizza dough. And today I'm very, very pleased to have as my guest a woman who is really breaking new ground, especially with vegetables, and someone who I think a lot of young and aspiring chefs look up to because she just got 2 stars from the New York Times for her real groundbreaking restaurant, Dirt Candy, which is on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. And Amanda Cohen, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
Well, there's really a lot to get into because not only did Dirt Candy get 2 stars from the New York Times, but your background is really interesting. You've worked through lots of vegetarian restaurants, you've worked with raw restaurants, you've worked with, you know, pure food and heirloom, and
right.
and you have a blog, and you have a fantastic cookbook that came out in August called Dirt Candy, and it has a look of its own. It's not your typical cookbook. It's done in a cartoon style and full chock-a-block full of your real original recipes. So let's get right down to it. About you. You're from Canada, right?
I am from Canada. I was born in Ottawa, but raised in Toronto.
So that sounds like root vegetable country to me. So what was your food like when you were growing up? Did you eat a lot of vegetables?
We did actually. Ontario is actually sort of like the produce belt. It has amazing vegetables and lots of farmers markets and lots of farms. I mean, you see sort of even now, I'll get a delivery of carrots and it'll come from Ontario. And the produce was...
Oh, wait, can I go back there and ask you how long is the growing season?
Not that long. It depends where you are. I mean, Canada's really big, so there are parts where, you know, it's 4 months, and there's parts where it can be 8 months. It just depends.
So you have Vancouver and British Columbia,
yeah,
like
exactly.
We have California.
Yeah, exactly. The food when I was young, though, I mean, I'm almost 40. So that was 40 years ago, and food has changed a lot. So I don't remember as much fresh vegetables as we got now. I mean, you did, in the end, eat a lot more sort of seasonally, and there was only sort of potatoes and carrots and turnips when I was young. And
did you like them?
Yes. Well, I mean, who doesn't love potatoes?
Well, there are a lot of people that avoid them, but root vegetables are not usually center plate, you know, likes of people,
no.
You know, so anyway, but what was your, did you come from a vegetarian household?
No, not at all. A very sort of meat oriented household. I have a large family, so I have 4 siblings, and you know, it was just a struggle every day to like get something that we all liked to eat. And but we like to eat. So I come from a very food oriented family. It's definitely one of those families that when they, you know, went on vacation, the whole vacation was, where are we going to eat next? You know, you'd finish breakfast and you'd start looking at menus, you know, for where we're going to eat lunch and where are we going to eat dinner. So food was very central to us. But no, when I was a kid, I was a meat eater. So I definitely ate a lot of steak and chicken. And
so you grew up in Ottawa?
Yeah.
And what got you out of Ottawa?
Well, we moved to Toronto. And then sort of my last year of high school in Toronto, I decided that I needed to come to New York and, you know, explore a bigger city. You know, you get a little taste. You move from Ottawa, which is a beautiful, beautiful city, but small. And we went to Toronto, which was much more sort of ethnically diverse and sort of culturally fascinating and big. And it's like, oh, there's so much more out there in the world. What could an even bigger city sort of, you know, give to me? and that was New York.
So you're an urban person at heart.
Definitely, definitely. Surprisingly, for somebody who loves vegetables, I'm not a farm girl.
I was going to get into the gardening part later, but so you came to New York as a college student, right?
Yeah.
NYU.
Yeah.
And you studied?
I studied cultural anthropology.
And why?
Well, honestly, it was because that was sort of the degree that had the least number of requirements. And I wanted to study a lot of different things. And I was interested in film and economics and politics. And so it was the degree at NYU that sort of had the least number of requirements so that I could study so many different courses. But also I was fascinated by it. And there is this sort of, by the end of my time there, I really did sort of develop this fascination with cultures and their food and how food brought over from, this was sort of my whole ending term, but how food brought over from another country tended to stay the same in this country, whereas it had really changed in other countries. So you see traditional foods, and often they're actually more traditional in sort of New York or Toronto or in the States than they are back in their original country. And that was something that fascinated me.
That is an interesting. So wait, when you were at NYU, what did you think you would do after college? Did you have a dream of being a chef then?
No, I really didn't, actually. I loved to cook, and I cooked a lot when I was a kid and as a teenager. But NYU, I was lost. And I graduated having no clue what I wanted to do. And I actually moved to Hong Kong right afterwards.
Did you really? How did you choose that and why?
My husband and I used to watch a lot of the movies from Hong Kong. And
Bruce Lee movies?
Bruce Lee, a lot of Shaw Brother movies, a lot of just sort of like fun Hong Kong, sort of culturally sort of like poppy movies. There used to be a movie theater in Chinatown called Music Palace, and you could get two movies for $6, and those were our dates. And we just sort of fell in love with the idea of this country and how like fascinating it was. And so as a lot of people moved to America for the movies, we moved to Hong Kong for the movies. And we spent about a year and a half there, and it was just sort of this mind-blowing experience. But I still didn't know what I wanted to do with
my
life.
Wait, let's go back to Hong Kong. What happens? You arrive in Hong Kong. Is it expensive to live there? I think it's one of the most expensive real estate cities in the world. Do you have to have a visa? Did you support yourself there? What went on?
Well, I was lucky. Because I'm Canadian, I could actually work for 3 months. So at the time, it was still part of the Commonwealth.
Ah, good.
And so both of us. So I had that link. And it is very expensive, but I was 20. I just turned 21, and I had a lot of energy. So we both had 4 or 5 jobs at the time. We were waiting tables, and I was working in an insurance company. I was doing their training manuals. I was teaching English. I was teaching French. I was just all this series of jobs. And so we made enough money to live. And eventually one of the jobs sponsored us to stay on for a year and change.
And what were some of the takeaways that are with you today? How did it change your living in a Chinese culture?
Well, first of all, it was the food. I mean, really sort of the time I was vegetarian, and I had never really eaten amazing vegetarian food before. And there is a whole culture of vegetarian food, Buddhist cuisine. We'd go to these restaurants, and it was what we were being served, nothing had ever been served beforehand. I didn't know there was so many different kinds of mock meat and tofu, and what somebody could do with the food was sort of fascinating. I mean, I think we spend most of our time eating. And just the appreciation of food and how important it was in the culture is really what I took away from that. And then a little bit of Cantonese.
Had you studied, when you were studying anthropology, had you studied Chinese?
No, not at all.
No?
Not at all. I went in blindly. I mean, now I look back on it and I think I was such a brave 21-year-old.
Yes, you were.
I just stepped off the plane and found a hostel.
Wow. So you, after a year and a half, why did you come back?
I had to. I mean, the visa ran out. And I think we knew that that wasn't where we were going to live forever. And then I spent 6 months sort of traveling.
Where did you travel through?
Japan and China and India. Well, a lot of fun doing that. And then I ended up in L.A. There's a whole series of things where I sort of ended up in L.A. still not knowing what I wanted to do. And eventually I sort of, you know, had to really look deep inside of myself and be like, what do you want to do? And what I came up with is that I wanted to travel. I loved exploring Hong Kong. I loved exploring Japan and China. And I was like, I need to do this. I want to see more of the world. And I was like, but I can't afford it. I need to find a skill that's going to take me to all these countries where I can always rely on it. And I was a terrible server, so I knew that wasn't going to be my skill. And I figured, well, you know, I really like to cook. So maybe if I go to cooking school, I can have this skill and I'll travel with it. And then I ended up in New York and I went to cooking school.
You went to Natural Gourmet,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. Which was perfect for me because I was still a vegetarian at the time.
When did you become a vegetarian?
When I was 16.
And what made you become a vegetarian?
I wish I had a better reason, but the truth is it was peer pressure. All my friends were vegetarian at the time. So it was about 25 years ago, and it was a really good way to rebel.
Why do you think, you know, 16-year-old girls were choosing to be vegetarians? Was it diet or?
I think actually it was partially diet, but I think also this was just sort of on the cusp of the sort of environmental movement. Mm-hmm. And, you know, being good to the earth, what was what we were being taught in school. And I think everybody sort of figured that eating animals was bad and it wasn't good for the planet. And this is what, you know, we could do to save the planet, that and recycling. It wasn't really quite well thought out. And so everybody, all my friends became vegetarians at this one time. And it was really, it was sort of shocking. I know it's hard to believe. And there was a whole vegetarian movement in the 70s and 80s. But all of a sudden, all these sort of young kids were becoming vegetarian. And my parents thought I was going to die. They were like, you will not be able to survive not, you know, not eating meat. And I was like, oh, this is awesome. Not only am I doing something good for the planet, but I've managed to really annoy my parents.
So
this is win-win.
How seriously was it taken to do it for sustainable reasons, like getting the right amount of proteins? And
I mean, I was the worst vegetarian ever. Yeah, I just probably ate cheese and junk food. It certainly wasn't for any, my nutritional, what I was putting in nutritionally was probably awful, but no worse than any other 16-year-old. It just didn't happen to have processed meat.
Right.
You know, it just happened to have a lot of cheese and macaroni and cheese and pizza.
So, yeah, the typical diet. Of,
yeah, exactly.
So you could hardly tell you were vegetarian.
Yeah. I just didn't have, you know, chicken wings a lot.
Right. Right. Yeah, so now you're in LA. I would imagine in LA they have a lot of great vegetarian restaurants. And
they did. They had a lot of healthy restaurants. But at the time, I don't actually think the LA food scene had come into its own. There were still a lot of old school restaurants that really were more about the scene than the food.
Uh-huh.
And although there was great Mexican food, I will say mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. That was my first introduction to really delicious Mexican food.
So now you've circled back to New York
yeah.
because you had been there as a student at NYU.
Yeah, and I had was the right school for me at the right time.
Natural Gourmet, yeah. And so then when you got out of there, did you go directly into restaurants?
I did. I never traveled again to work. So I never ended up living in another country and using this skill. I ended up staying in New York. And
is that disappointing to you?
Yeah, I actually, yeah. There's a lot of sort of looking at where I am in my career now and I have a restaurant, so I'm probably not going to be able to, you know, take 6 months off and travel again. And I think maybe I made some wrong decisions along the way. Or not necessarily wrong, but I wish I had made a couple of different ones. Because obviously all the decisions that I made brought me to this point.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I would love to have traveled more.
Mm-hmm. So what was the first job you got out of school?
I worked at, I had a couple of internships, but the first paying job in New York was at a place called Blanche's, and it was a healthy sort of little cafe that had stands around the city. Mm-hmm. And it was, this was actually tucked into a bigger restaurant in the meatpacking district, and we would sort of cook from I think 7 a.m. until noon when the kitchen came in, and we would make like hundreds of muffins a day and all vegan. And I just remember having to cart 5 gallons of maple syrup up and down the stairs and thinking, I'm not strong enough to do this. How can I do it? And, you know, I was shy and young. And I remember it would take me like 20 minutes to get up the stairs one step at a time. Okay, I can lift it. I can lift it. I can lift it. And, but it was good. You learn what you can do, right? And then you're really excited when there's only 3 gallons left in the bucket. On the way down, it was always much better.
My gosh. I mean, that would be hard for the guys too.
Yes, but they were less likely to show it. And, you know, you don't want to ask for help.
That's right, in a kitchen. How different was a kitchen from going to school?
I think, you know, and we've just I've started talking about this a lot. Schools are really, it's an easy place to learn. It's such a safe place to learn. And in a restaurant kitchen, it feels very unsafe to ask questions. And I think that was the biggest realization that, you know, you're on your own a little. You have to figure stuff out. People aren't there to help you. They're kind of only there to help themselves. And so it's very intimidating to figure everything out and ask where things are. And, you know, in cooking school, I didn't care. I was like, could you please get that off a shelf for me? I'm only 5'1". And then in a restaurant, you really have to sort of be like, okay, I can't get this. Either I have to ask this person for help, or I'm going to have to go find a stool and climb up and have everybody watch me.
That's interesting. Yeah. That is interesting. Is there not more teamwork than that?
There is teamwork in a kitchen. I don't think there was then, and I think it's just starting now. I think you see a lot kinder kitchens now where people want other people to learn, and they're more willing to share. But definitely when I started out, it was a, you know, everybody, every man for themselves. You know, who's going to get ahead? Who's this person working next to me? Am I better than them? Are they my competition? Am I going to, you know, get promoted? Are they going to get promoted?
All right. Well, we're going to take a break here. And when we come back, we're going to finish your journey and see where dirt candy came from.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today. Today's program has been brought to you by AmeriCraft. AmeriCraft and 360 Cookware are proud sponsors of HeritageRadioNetwork.org. AmeriCraft is an American company, and like Heritage Radio Network, they provide the best. Their 360 Cookware is made of the highest quality ingredients, like United States steel. It is made in the greenest cookware manufacturing plant in the world. AmeriCraft makes great cookware and is focused on improvement. 360 Cookware is their exclusive line. It's a contemporary line of cookware and bakeware intended to let you, the Heritage Radio Network listeners, have a unique cooking experience. Its vapor seal allows food to be cooked in its natural juices, preserving all of the vitamins, minerals, and other nutrients without added water, oils, or fats. 360 Cookware invites you to learn more about how this process works on their website, www.360cookware.com.
Well, welcome back. You're listening to Chef's Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton from the International Culinary Center. And today, my guest is Amanda Cohen, the chef and owner of Dirt Candy here in New York City. And we're just talking about her journey from being born in Canada and around the world, Hong Kong, L.A. And now we're back in New York, and you've graduated school. What was your journey through different kitchens? Were you, I want to work in vegetarian kitchens? What propelled you through?
Well, I knew I wanted to work in kitchens. So right after cooking school, sort of in between jobs, I had private chef for a while. And I knew about 2 weeks into it, it wasn't for me. I liked the camaraderie in a kitchen. I liked working with other people. I felt very lonely as a private chef. And so I knew that I wanted to stick with working in kitchens. And, I had to be realistic about what I could do and what I was going to eat. And at the time I was a very serious vegetarian, and it wouldn't have been fair to me or to the kitchen not to stick in vegetarian kitchens. Like, I couldn't really taste the food. I wouldn't want to taste the food in at sort of a more mainstream restaurant, and I wouldn't like what I was tasting. And you do have to like the food you're making in a kitchen. It's really important, and you have to want to taste it. I have cooks all the time who don't really like food, and they don't want to taste what they're making, and I think you're not going to make
You have cooks who don't like food?
Yeah, it's a skill. You know, they cook because it's a skill, but not because they love food.
That's amazing.
So, to me too, because all I like to do is eat. And so I kind of knew that I had to stick with vegetarian kitchens. And I knew that I was skilled, but if I was ever going to go into a more mainstream kitchen, I had to get a lot more skills where I could at least rely on my skill, if not my palate, as I was learning. Mm-hmm. I worked in a ton of different vegetarian restaurants, and I would stay for about a year and a half in each of them, and try to get as much information as possible out of them before I would move on.
And so where did the idea for Dirt Candy and where did the courage for Dirt Candy come from?
Well, at one point I sort of had reached my end of vegetarian restaurants in the city, and I had taken a couple of jobs and they hadn't worked out, and it was either sort of try to do my own thing or keep working in these restaurants but on the same level. It would always be a lateral move. I would never go up the ladder, and I really felt, well, here's my moment. Either I take it or, you know, maybe I do something else. But I can't keep working in these same restaurants. And you get to a point where you want to do your own thing. I had a voice. I wanted to share what I love doing and what I thought food could be. And I wasn't going to be able to do it in any of these other kitchens. And at the time, what I wanted to do was a little bit different. It wasn't sort of the mainstream vegetarian cooking. And it wasn't the mainstream vegetable cooking either. So, you know, I took a step back and it's like, okay, let's do this. Let's open a tiny little restaurant that, you know, can sustain itself, and we will dedicate it to vegetables. And when I think back to 4 years ago and even now, there are so many restaurants that are dedicated to meat and chicken and fish, and they're all wonderful. And there isn't a single restaurant dedicated to vegetables in all of America. There isn't one that's full sort of goal is to promote vegetables.
Even vegetarian restaurants.
Yeah, vegetarian restaurants have very little to do with vegetables. That's a whole different, vegetarian restaurants tend to be more dedicated to the lifestyle of vegetarianism versus really promoting vegetables.
That's true, because you have yogurts and granolas and breads and
mock meat, and it's really... And this is changing, but it is more about sort of the diet versus the food itself. This is vegetarian restaurants sort of come out of this. The history of vegetarian restaurants in a nutshell is in the early 1900s, you had the sort of ethical vegetarian restaurants, which came out of the Yiddish societies. And there were tons of Jewish sort of cafeterias that only served vegetarian food, and it really was because they felt eating meat was ethically and morally wrong. And so they dedicated themselves to, you know, making vegetarian food. And if you go back and read some of those menus, it's appalling. And then you also had this sort of idea about vegetarian food from the health nuts, which also came around in the 1900s, like Kellogg's and Graham. And they really, you know, felt that eating meat was bad for your body, and it was bad for sort of your mental health and your physical health, and that the less meat you ate, the healthier you would be, and eating meat would just lead to a disaster of life. And so then you had the health nuts, and you have the sort of moral and ethical society, and then you had this movement in the 60s and 70s that came out of the environment and being good to the earth. And, you know, sort of eating more organic food and local food. And again, if you look at some of those menus from the 60s and 70s, they're also appalling, like nut loaves were just the food people wanted to eat. And that's where we ended up right now with vegetarian restaurants. And none of those three things are about the food. Mm-hmm. It's all about something else. It's about, you know, how you feel about eating meat, how you feel about your body, and how you feel about the environment. And that's really the tradition that vegetarian restaurants come out of, mm-hmm. and are still sort of stuck in that to this day, but are starting to leave it behind. And that's why we kind of call it a lifestyle restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And none of that. It's about the food, and I want to be about the food. I'm not a vegetarian anymore, but at the time I was, but it was never because of, you know, sort of any of those reasons. For me, it was like, I liked eating vegetables. I love what one can do with vegetables, and that there was no restaurant where I could go to and find the food I wanted to eat was mind-blowing.
How'd you come up with the name Dirt Candy?
Well, I guess I was sitting around with my husband, and we were trying to figure out, you know, a name that would be catchy and would be interesting and something that people would remember. And at the time, there was a bunch of restaurants that were coming out with one name. So they'd be like Fork, Spoon, Table, Green. And I just kept thinking, those aren't Googleable. You have to have something that people can look up and find and remember. And we were talking about what vegetables were, and I said something, you know, well, vegetables are like candy from the earth. And my husband said right away, Dirt Candy.
Wow.
And it was that moment. We were like, okay, we'll stick with it. And we know we've had lots of people who haven't liked the name, and it's often the first
really?
Line.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I think it's so clever.
Well, there's lots of articles written about us that worst name of a restaurant ever, but great restaurant. And I think, whatever. Everybody remembers the name.
That's right.
And that's what's important.
That's what's important. So so you went in full-fledged to be a vegetable restaurant.
Yeah.
What's your favorite dish you've ever put on the menu?
Sometimes I like them all and sometimes I hate them all. But I think the one that I'm the most proud of is our portobello mousse. And it was intended to sort of be an answer to foie gras. And I'm not trying to replace foie gras. People can eat whatever they want to eat. But I wanted to give people who couldn't eat foie gras a chance to sort of taste what that is and explore sort of that decadent, creamy fattiness. And I think
how do you make a portobello mushroom creamy and fatty?
You add a lot of fat.
So
a lot of cream, a lot of butter. Although we do have a vegan version, and you know, we managed to set it with agar. And when you spread it, it has that same sort of mouthfeel. It's very decadent. And I think that we were able to do that.
So you do it as a loaf.
We do it as a little cube.
Cube.
But you can do it however.
So it's not like raw foie gras that's sauteed. It's more terrine of foie gras.
Yeah, it's a terrine. Mm-hmm. Cooked. Although we have tried to sear it before, and it does work.
Mm.
It has that creaminess.
Mm-hmm.
It has that sort of like, mm-hmm. I'm eating almost
mouthfeel.
Pure butter. Yeah.
Yeah.
That a good foie gras apparently has. I've actually never had foie gras.
Oh.
But I've been told it's very close.
Oh, good. So, I have to go try it.
So I think it was a good dish for vegetarians, and it was a great dish for meat eaters, for the carnivores who came in who thought, you know, I'm never going to like this restaurant. It's not going to be satisfying. It's not going to have that sort of decadence that I look for when I go out to eat. And when people eat this dish, they think, wow, this is amazing. This is something that you can do with vegetables that doesn't feel like I'm punishing myself.
So tell me, when you were conceiving the restaurant, what were some of the structural things you said? It should be this size, this, you know, how did you come up with all of that concept?
Well, what I knew what I wanted was a restaurant that wasn't going to fail. And so most importantly, I was looking for a space that I could control. I didn't want something that was going to overwhelm me, because I knew already that I was going to be overwhelmed just by opening a restaurant. How can you not? I had opened enough restaurants with other people to sort of watch them go crazy. And I felt that I needed something that I could manage, and that if it didn't do okay, if it failed, it would still survive. And I would be able to, you know, run it with a skeletal crew, and it wouldn't be that hard. I wouldn't lose the shirt off my back. And so we looked for a space that was small enough for, you know, just about, you know, 20 people to come in and eat, and, you know, that I could make some profit off of, and that it had to sort of fit where it was. And that's why we ended up in the Lower East Side in the East Village. You know, it had to be in a sort of young, fun neighborhood where it could either be a neighborhood restaurant, or it could also be a local or a destination restaurant.
How many seats do you have in the restaurant?
We have 18.
18. And how many covers do you do a night?
About 56 to 60.
Wow. Yeah. So that's sort of triple turning.
Yes.
So what time do you start and what time do you finish? And
we start at 5:30 and we seat on Tuesdays and Wednesdays, we seat our last table around 10 o'clock. And on every other night, we finish at 10:30. But we're only open 5 days a week. So Tuesday through Saturday. And we have this crew and everybody work. It's an office job. You work 5 days a week. You know exactly what your schedule is going to be. And it's a very small, tight crew.
How many people on your crew?
I have about six, including me, and I am there every single day.
And that includes the wait staff and the dishwasher? And
wait staff, dishwasher. We have one server. And
so when you were organizing the, did you have to go out and find backers, or are you family and friends? Or
I had some money. So the restaurant is my restaurant, solely mine.
So that's why you wanted it to work with 18 diners a night. And when you opened, how many diners did you get in your first year?
One night we had 12 people, and that was the night of the election. So it was 2008. Mm-hmm. And every other night, I don't think we ever did less than 30.
Oh, so.
So we were doing okay from the first, from the moment we opened.
Right. And how did the press treat you?
I think they were a little confused at first. We sort of came out with our guns blazing. We were like, we're here. We're a real restaurant. We want you to treat us like a real restaurant. We have a PR company. You know, we're not embarrassed about the food we eat. We're not a lifestyle restaurant. We're not vegetarian. And we kept trying to, like, drive this point home. We're a vegetable restaurant. Please, when you write about us as a vegetable restaurant, not as a vegetarian restaurant. And I think at first they were very sort of taken aback, and they didn't know how to treat us and, you know, what we were going to be like. And it took a long time for them to sort of warm up to the idea of what we were, and that, you know, we were serving, although we were a vegetable restaurant, we were serving mainstream food, and we were just sort of, you know, doing it with a little bit more personality than others.
Okay, well, we're going to have to take another break. And when we come back, we're going to pursue a bit more on this business of running a restaurant. Welcome back. You're listening to Chef's Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton. And today my guest is Amanda Cohen from Dirt Candy, a restaurant on the Lower East Side. And she has a new cookbook, Dirt Candy, that came out this past August, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. But we were talking about her opening her own restaurant, and it's a vegetable restaurant, not vegetarian. And new concept. And so out of the box, how did you know to hire a PR firm? And why, you know, on a restricted budget, would you do that?
I feel in this day and age, if you don't have a PR firm, it's almost impossible to survive. And that's very unfortunate. There's so many restaurants in New York. And if you want to compete with every other single restaurant that's opening up, you've got to push your name forward. You've got to get somebody out there who's fighting for you to get covered in, and not just sort of in the newspapers, but like online. There's so many blogs, and how are they going to find out about you, and why are they going to want to come? And I feel like without a PR company these days, you just can't.
All right. So I know a lot of cooks listen to this program, while, especially now while they're prepping, and a lot of people want to have their own restaurant. Isn't it, you know, can't you follow the maxim, build it and they will come, you know? And if you're just an amazing cook and you open a small place, you don't need the PR, you don't need, I mean, what's the reality of running your own restaurant as a chef who loves to cook? Do you get to cook?
Not as much as I'd like to. I mean, I am there every night working the line. So I get to do that, but I don't have as much time to explore and experiment like I used to. Running the restaurant itself is a full-time job.
What does that mean? What are you doing?
and it's funny. All these chefs have this dream of opening a small restaurant that's my size. And people are always like, oh, it's my dream size restaurant. And I think, be careful what you wish for. There isn't enough money to hire a reservationist. There isn't enough money to hire sort of a daily bookkeeper. Who's going to answer all the emails that come in? Who's going to answer the complaints? Who's going to answer the congratulatory emails? And, you know, who's going to go to the Bowery and pick up new pots? And so that takes up time. That's just physical time that you spend running this restaurant that has nothing to do with cooking. And that's very hard to sort of understand. You know, I wake up at 8 a.m. I'm at the restaurant usually by 9:30. And I spend 6 hours dealing with the restaurant itself. And then I cook. And then I get on the line and I set my station up for the night. And it's not at all how I thought it would be. I thought I'd have all this time to experiment in the kitchen. And, you know, oh, it'd take, you know, maybe an hour to do the books or to do the reservations. And it doesn't. And unfortunately, because of the size of the restaurant and because of our sort of profit margins, there isn't somebody who's going to call it back everybody for the reservations. And so that falls on me, which is fun for people when they answer the phone. I'm like, oh, hi, this is Amanda from Dirt Candy. But it's a time problem.
Sure. So, you know, there are very few or there are fewer women chef owners than men. Do you think there's any gender issues here? Is it harder to be a woman chef or is it just the world perception is different?
Oh, I think I'm not sure it's harder. I mean, the job is hard no matter what. I'm not sure if I think my day-to-day is harder than a male chef's, but I think it's harder in this world to sort of prove yourself and to get the recognition that you need to sort of survive as a woman chef. It's still...
Recognition from whom?
Magazines, websites, the mainstream press, television. And that's the... In a way, television has done great things for women chefs, and in another way, it hasn't. I think, you know, you watch a show like Top Chef, and you see these women who are doing things that you wouldn't expect that you can do in a kitchen. Or I didn't know very many corporate female chefs before Top Chef, or women who are running, you know, hotel kitchens. You don't see that a lot. You do hear more about the sort of smaller kitchens that women run. And so I think Top Chef or shows like that have been great for women chefs. But at the same time, you look at the Food Network and there are a lot of women who cook, but they're not necessarily represented as restaurant chefs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you have all of that. You have television that isn't helping women chefs. I think you have the mainstream media. I think you have things like the best new chefs. And you see these lists all the time. And more often than not, there's just one woman on them. Mm-hmm. It feels like there's a token woman every single year.
You know, and it is sort of like they've looked. Yes. Oh, we didn't put the woman in. Let's go find one and add her. I mean, it would be so much nicer if there were three or four.
Well,
and,
exactly. Yeah. If it didn't feel like a struggle every year to find that chef.
Do you think women find it harder to find funding to open their own restaurants?
I definitely think this is a huge, huge problem. I think people who tend to want to invest in restaurants sort of, you know, do it because it looks like sexy and fun. And I'm going to get to hang out and party. And from my sort of experience, that people tend to think of that more as like somebody who you'd go party with the male chef and not with the, you know, female chef. And, you know, it is a struggle, and you don't see women getting these big, huge investors, and you see very few women running huge kitchens that have multi-million dollars behind them. And I think there's still a trust problem. I think a lot of investors don't think women can run kitchens as successfully as men, and I don't think they want to be as supportive. And there is a huge problem with women chefs leaving the kitchen after they having children and not being welcomed back into it and having to make that choice. And
isn't that a fair criticism of an investor saying, look at this woman. What if she, you know, I put $5 million into this restaurant and then she gets pregnant and goes off and has a baby. I mean, that strikes me as maybe a fair.
It's fair, but I think if it was more supportive, the women would want to come back and they would say, you know what, let me take 6 months off. You know, I'll still keep
like in business.
Exactly. Yeah. And I'll come
three
back.
Months.
All of us who have struggled for so hard to sort of make it to get to that point.
Yes.
very few of us want to give up and, you know, turn our back
that's
on
a,
it.
That's a good point.
So, you know.
Do you run your kitchen differently as a woman than other kitchens you've been in? And if so, how?
I think I run a much nicer kitchen. It doesn't mean I don't yell and scream sometimes, but we do try to sort of keep it as a teaching kitchen. And so we take a lot of interns and we try to stay very calm and we don't shout and scream a lot. And we try to let people ask questions and make it feel like a very safe environment. I still have, you know, people who come in who are come from these sort of very sort of like 1970s, 80s kitchens where there's a chef who stood there and screamed at them. And that's what they like. And they get upset when I'm not yelling at them. And I think, but how are you possibly learning? And, you know, that was so old school. Let's make this new school.
You know what? Gordon Ramsay's kitchen, whatever it's called, Hell's Kitchen, yeah. Whatever. I mean, I don't know anybody who would live in that environment. And, you know, that's so entertainment. And they say he yells and screams, but, you know, how many people work for him?
I think that's a lot of TV. And I think people take that. Yeah. And, you know, I worked in a kitchen sort of right after Kitchen Confidential came out. Mm. And I was with all these male chefs, and they were actually much older than I was. And they were all really excited by this book. And they're like, yeah, that's how the kitchen is. And everybody yells and scream. And this is so awesome. And he's telling it like it is. And I was like, but why are you proud of this? Yeah. I was like, that's awful. Yeah. I've left kitchens like that. I won't work in a kitchen like that anymore. As soon as I could start to choose where I wanted to work, I knew instantly that I didn't want to be in that loud, screaming kitchen where I felt intimidated.
You know what? I heard the direct opposite. Andre Sultner, the chef owner of Lutèce, he read the excerpt in The New Yorker, and he refused to read the book because he said, you know what? That is not a real kitchen. If we acted like that in the kitchen, it's not respectful to the food. And he came from a different kitchen discipline. So that's kind of, it's very interesting. I do think, and this is a different conversation, that women run their kitchens much more in a different manner and much more nurturing. And we have to get into that someday. So let's talk a little bit about your book, because your book looks like a comic book in the nicest way. And why would you choose writing a food manifesto as a comic book?
Well, we wanted people to notice it. When people started approaching us about writing a book, and I was very against it at the beginning, and I had worked in kitchens where the chef sort of 6 months into it had started writing their cookbook, and the kitchen had started to sort of fail, and they weren't there and they weren't in charge. And I was like, why are you writing a restaurant cookbook? The restaurant hasn't even been open. What story do you have to tell? And I was so opposed to this, but then people kept coming, and finally I was like, fine, we'll start thinking about it. And I didn't want a traditional cookbook. I wanted something that was really going to represent sort of the high energy fun that we have at the restaurant and how different we are and how we do things a little differently. And it just felt that, you know, that traditional cookbook where you have a little introductory paragraph and then the recipe and a really pretty picture, it wasn't going to do us any justice, and it wasn't going to be a fun read. And the restaurant's so much fun, and we really wanted to translate that into the page. And it seemed like this sort of graphic novel form would really work, and we could tell our story of the restaurant. We could make it really interesting, and, you know, we could present the recipes, which were going to be complicated. We make very complicated food at the restaurant, and I did not want to put the real recipes in. I wanted it to be true to what we serve, but in the graphic novel form, we could really sort of break it up and make them seem much simpler. And they wouldn't be so intimidating. So somebody could not only read this cookbook, but they could use this cookbook.
It's great. There are vignettes that, you know, where someone's not ordering the produce and you walk in and, why didn't you tell me this? And why didn't you do something? You really do capture the life of behind the scenes in a restaurant. It's a great book. Go on Amazon, Dirk Candy. Okay, so we have to circle back to one statement because we're getting ready to end the program. You're not a vegetarian anymore. What? Tell us about that journey and why not, and what do you eat now?
Well, I eat fish. Every once in a while I'll try something else, but I haven't tried anything that's really made me decide not to be a pescatarian. I'm still waiting for that moment. About 8 years ago, I had actually called up a very fancy restaurant, and I said, you know, I'm coming for dinner. I know you do tasting menus. Can you do a vegetarian tasting menu? And they were like, yes, we're very excited to do this. And, you know, don't worry, the chef will take care of it. And I was like, great. And I went, and I was there with my parents and my husband, and each tasting menu was $150. So my husband and I got the vegetarian one, and my parents got the regular one. And I think it was 8 courses. And I swear, every single one was a salad. There was the amuse salad. There was the soup salad. There was appetizer salad, entree salad, cleanser salad, and salad dessert. And it was the most disappointing sort of meal of my life. I was so excited. I was so excited to eat there. And I was still charged the same amount of money. I was horrified. And I sort of had this epiphany. I was like, you know, what my parents ate looked delicious. And I really wish I was eating that. And I'm never going to grow as a chef if I can't taste what other chefs really care about. And they obviously don't care about vegetarians. You know, I had been to lots of restaurants where I had had the vegetarian plate. And it was the same plate over and over again. Grilled eggplant, grilled zucchini, a portobello mushroom, and some sort of side grain that was being served on another dish that they had plopped into the middle. And I was so bored of that. And it just felt that, how am I going to sort of learn what the rest of the world likes to eat if I can't taste it? If I'm not, you know, eating the protein on the plate, which is what the chefs, particularly at that time, really cared about. So I slowly started to eat fish.
Do you have disciples that have worked with you in the restaurant? Now they've gone out and they're doing vegetable restaurants. Do you think you've started a trend?
I think I've started a trend. I don't think anybody who has worked for me has gone out yet, mostly because I try not to let people who work for me leave. I like to keep my staff. I'll do anything to keep them. But I do think that this sort of vegetable movement is catching on, mm-hmm. and that you see lots more restaurants who are starting to care about their vegetables. And, you know, you have Meatless Mondays and you have more vegetable tasting menus. And just from sort of the success of my restaurant, you can see there's an audience out there who not just likes to eat vegetables, but who's a little bit more adventurous and doesn't need to eat, you know, a steak with every meal or a piece of chicken or a pork chop, whatever it is. They're willing to say, you know what, we go out to eat a lot. And one night I might eat, you know, this pork belly. And another night I want to eat all vegetables. And you're starting to see the audience for that. And you're starting to see chefs catch on.
Wow. Well, if you can get a reservation, I think it's a 2-month wait right now.
At the moment.
At the moment. But if you try 5:30, sometimes you can get in. Make it over to Dirt Candy. It is truly an exciting, original, and delicious restaurant. Amanda, thanks for coming by today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Open more. Open more.
I would love to.
Okay, thanks, and see you next time.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.